Hello gamers and welcome to Game Warp. I'm Elwood.
I'm Kim.
And this is our review of the book Ready Player One. This is a slight change of pace for ourselves here on Game Warp, as we are actually reviewing a book for a change. We're not actually reviewing a game, but because of the connections this book has to both gaming and popular culture, we thought we might as well, you know, share our thoughts and throw a hat in the ring and basically discuss this book, especially as the film version is heading to screens very soon, directed by Steven Spielberg. The book itself, Ready Player One, it was released back in 2011, and it's written by Ernest Cline. It was his debut novel. The book itself is set in the year 2044, where the world has basically been thrown into this post-apocalyptic setting, where due to the energy crisis and there being no fossil fuels, it's basically thrown the world into chaos. There's global warming, there's all the kinds of social problems, so people now live in essentially stacks, which are consist of RV vans sort of stacked one on top of the other, and you've seen the pictures or any promotional material, and this has been one of the key images that's been passed around. So people have decided to escape to essentially their version of the internet now, known as the Oasis, which is a combination of like the internet and virtual reality, where you can basically escape into other worlds. And it's not only a game, but it's also turned into this whole virtual society. So you can visit different worlds, you can attend schools, you can do business. Basically, you can live your whole life in the Oasis, and this is what people have chosen to do. Now, this was the creation of a program known as called James Halliday, who, when he died, basically set up this competition where you had to find this egg he had placed in the Oasis, known as Halliday's Egg. And the first person to find this egg wins his entire fortune and the corporation, and basically control over the Oasis. And this is what the story follows. So we see follow our hero, Wade Watts, who now, about 5 years after this announcement was made, finally discovers one of the three required keys to locate this treasure, and inadvertently finds himself on this quest, teaming up with other Gunters, who are the name of these people who are dedicated to this quest, along the way trying to avoid the evil corporation players known as Sixers, who are determined to capture the egg for their own nefarious needs. But, I mean, Kim, opening thoughts on Ready Player One. I mean, this is a book that's received so much hype. I mean, there's a number of critics that I respect their opinion. I mean, such as, like, Nick Rehack over at French Toast Sunday. I mean, he raved about this book and said that he picked it up and couldn't put it down. And the combination of that and the film version obviously coming out made me kind of keen to check this out. But, I mean, what did you think of this book?
You know, in one word, I guess not one word, but like one sentence, I would say that this is a really, really appealing idea. The concept of it is done so well. My only issues I had with it was the execution of how it was done and the balance it chose to take on. You know, sometimes I'm reading this book and I can't figure out if I'm reading an 80s fanboy documentary or if I'm actually reading an exciting treasure hunt story, you know?
Oh, definitely so. I think this is a book where we have to accept the fact that Cline is wearing his influences and his loves very much on his sleeve. I think it's basically like it's very much a problem with nostalgia. It's sort of like, and this is one of the main issues with this book, is the fact that it's very nostalgia-based. It's sort of like saying, here, remember all these things that you like from the 80s? Well, here they are in this, that we've tied them up in this storyline. So we've got retro video games, we've got references to popular movies such as War Games, and it sort of feels so overwhelming, the fact that we're constantly being bombarded with this. It's like Bret Easton Ellis is in his constant use of labels. It's sort of, I've never seen someone so obsessed with things that they overwhelm the story like they do here.
Yeah, but that's the thing is, you know, like there has to be, you know, a careful balance between the two. You know, there are solid examples, say, like, you know, say Easy A does a Easy A the movie is very a tribute to, you know, John Hughes and all these like 80s movies and that sort of romantic comedy, and they're kind of joking about in a way where, you know, they're paying homage to a lot of these movies that work because of those coming of age stories that was in that time. And, you know, they used it with puns, with little things. But here is different because it's like we get like, that's the problem, is that I think that they're scared that people nowadays reading, say, this sort of young adult book will not understand the 80s because they haven't been in it. But the fact is that what this book really only needed to do was to show off the best parts of the 80s and not, like, give an elaborate description of it, you know? Then people will hunt down these things. They'll hunt down War Games. They'll hunt down Monty Python and the Holy Grail, or they'll hunt down whatever game they had or something like that, you know? People will try and hunt them down, especially now that, you know, all these classic games are hyped up, especially with the SNES and all that stuff, classic coming out and these little things being revived.
Yeah, it's, you know, so whenever we encounter some retro aspect to this game, one of his loves, so to speak, we have to then spend at least 3 or 4 pages being described what said thing is. And it's sort of like, it just felt like you're kind of like reading someone who's set out to like do like a review of his favorite nerdy items, and then partway through thought, oh, I don't want to do this, I want to perhaps, and then sort of like throws it into his novel that he was writing at the same time. So do I really need to know about the kill screen of Pac-Man? Do I really need to know about the ins and outs of War Games, for example? And it's sort of like this becomes so much a problem when we actually get into one of these trials that ties into it, such as there's numerous scenes where you have to play through like a film and you get awarded points for doing it. So we basically get the opening of War Games described to us, and it feels like so much filler that like it's not enough to say, oh, I've got to play through this. It's sort of like, oh, I'm doing this. And it's like he's so in love with these things that it becomes overwhelming, and it becomes very grating as it goes on, the fact how he describes and interacts with these nerdy drops that he includes throughout.
You know, like, I get that, you know, like, nearing the end of the book, he tends to kind of taper off a little. He kind of really realizes that he is diving a little bit too deep in many things. My main issues weren't even with, like, you know, crazy descriptions about movies. That's fine. You know, you can skip through them and be like, oh, well, he eventually got that, lost points here, blah, 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 you know? But sometimes, you know, you're going through these games, and before he even goes into the game, he looks at it and he's like, oh, I remember now that this is from this game. And then he describes the whole process of him gaming it and what these stages each do and all these things. And I'm like, you know what? If I was going to play this game after I read your book, I would not want to play it anymore, because you just put me through the entire experience and now I don't want it to go in there anymore. You know, like, and then, you know, he'll go into the actual, like, the character will go into the actual battle, and then it'll be like 2 lines, boom, boom, done, you know, and that's the end. That's not a treasure hunt. He didn't overcome anything. I just took a history lesson about, like, Joust or whatever that game was called, and then I got thrown out, and then, like, there was no excitement. It's just kind of like, you know, you're in this thing, and I'm like, I get so excited when we're talking about that treasure hunt adventure, and it's so fun, and then you see all these, like, evil corporations trying to steal this egg, and all this stuff is so great until you hit that, like, 3 to 5 page gap of, like, descriptions about things that ruin the next thing, because it just breaks that immersiveness. And I just find that that's so frustrating, because it's completely, like, an editing thing, you know? Like, I get that, I don't know who he chose for an editor, But I'm guessing the editor had the same love of the 80s as he did, because he didn't find it grating, obviously. So, you know, like, that's my problem with it is, you know, like, there's just so much description that breaks the immersiveness. Like, the idea is there, and the idea is great. Even the oasis, the world they build, the description, the expansiveness, and, like, just being able to see what this virtual reality is so captivating to look at. But it's just the fact, like, this is, like, a really important point that I feel that when you put something together, you really need to consider the fact that who are you trying to appeal to, you know? Like that was my main thing, is are you trying to make this, like, you know, I guess, like, if they're aiming for people who really, really like the 80s and want to dive into this book, and this is, like, oh, my God, this is, like, a trip back into the 80s. It's, you know, all 80s things that you love, and it just brings back all these memories. And then I'm like, but you're marketing it to the wrong group as well, because you're putting it into the YA category with all this, like, odd romance going on, and you have these, like, weird dialogue that kind of matches with kind of, like, the 80s style, but it's still, like, an YA novel that, like, you know, it's a little bit, like, cringy and stuff, and sometimes you're just like, I don't know who you're trying to appeal to. And that was my main issue, is that while I thought the book was, you know, fun when we were going on the treasure hunt, I still didn't feel like it was as immersive as people, like, gave the hype of, you know?
Oh, definitely so. And I feel that when we, early on, we've got this relationship between Wade and his best friend, H. And they're basically self-confessed 80s nerds, but the way they describe 80s nerds is they treat it with such, like, snobbishness that they're, like, the worst kind of geeks, is the fact that they berate people who aren't able to remember every nerdy little detail that they know about the 80s. And in a way, I feel that the character Wade is almost instantly hobbled in the first 100 pages, because whatever challenge he's up against, he's able to beat, because he's, like, played all these games, he's memorized everything from the Almanac, which is basically Halliday's guide of everything he ever loved. So anything he encounters, he has no problem beating it at all. There's no real challenge there. The only problem he has is figuring out clues. That seems to be the only time he's ever stuck. And it's sort of like, well, where's the challenge? Where's the quest here? I mean, his only sort of hindrance is the fact he's piss poor. That seems to be his only problem. And then when he gets the first key, and I'm just going to take this moment and say, we're just going to say spoilers ahead here, because if I'm ruining anything, I apologize in advance. And he basically instantly gets instant riches, so he has no problems, he can go anywhere, he can do anything there. And he sort of gets the first key, and then he basically spends the middle portion just sitting on his ass, relishing being this Oasis celebrity, and engaging in this questionable relationship with this female grunter and blogger, Artemis, who he's absolutely obsessed with, even though he has no idea what she looks like at all. And they engage in this, like, most cliche romance ever before she obviously disappears and he goes off into depression and whatnot. But, like, the whole scene that they get invited to this birthday party of, like, one of the founders of the Oasis, Og. And the whole scene is, like, so cliche written. He turns up in a DeLorean, and they're in the disco, they're playing all these 80s remixes and stuff, and it's sort of like, God, this is just painfully cliche at this point. Can we just, like, not everything has to be, like, you showing your deep dives into 80s pop culture and that, and it's sort of like,
I can almost hear the diehard fans of Ready Player One screaming as we're saying this, that we are missing the point, but we're not. And honestly, it's okay. I don't mind people liking this. Like I said, you know, like, there is a lot of merit to it, but it's just that, you know, sometimes too much of something is a little overwhelming. And that's one of the feelings you start feeling as you're reading this. And, like, pages and pages of the description is overwhelming feelings, you know? Like, everything is, you know, like, sure, you know, like, I don't know everything about the 80s. I'm not afraid to admit that. But I also don't need 10 pages to tell me about a game, you know? Or I don't need, like, you know, because it might have been 3 pages, it might have been 5 pages, whatever it was. It felt very long to go through.
It's, I think it suffers from the fact that, like, when you have people who like The Breakfast Club, and you can't possibly not like The Breakfast Club because it is this perfect movie, and because it's like when you talk to people, especially like 80s movies from their childhood, so like The Goonies and that, and they try to explain to someone who watches it now as an adult, and they don't get it. It's like, oh, why don't you get this? And I felt that very much anything reference to the 80s in here, it's absolutely perfect. It's without flaw in Klein's world vision that these things are absolutely perfect examples of what popular culture is, and that they're without fault and that. And I think it just like, it just really annoyed me. And especially when we get into the sections involving Rush, because Halliday is supposed to be this huge Rush fan. So we get to the final gate, and it's like, oh, we're going to have a Rush clue. And it's like the whole Rush back catalogue there. And knowing friends who like Rush, and if you know a friend who likes Rush, the chances are
AKA you. That's what I thought of when I first saw that scene. I remember it. I texted you, and I was like, oh my god, this Jim Halliday fellow reminds me so much of you.
I'm just saying that. I mean, I'm not as bad a Rush fan as some. There is some Rush fan. A lot of my friends who are like Rush fans, they won't acknowledge other bands exist. Like, you go in their car, and all their tapes are just like Rush tapes. And it's like, do you want to like listen to another band? It's like, what, the other bands than Rush? Because I mean, you know, Rush, the Canadian band. So Kim, you should be behind them. I mean, they have to rock.
I'm not behind them. I never said I'm like lukewarm. You know, I don't listen to them a lot, and that's all.
The thing is, Rush have to rock twice as hard as other bands because it's so cold in Canada. That's the thing. So, but anyway, we get to the final thing, and it's like, this is going to be the big payoff. We're going to do a Rush here. All everything's based around Rush, and it's like, oh, what can they possibly do? I mean, obviously, it's got to be Tom Sawyer. Tom Sawyer is like the classic gaming mixtape track, and like, no, it's Magic School Bus. Really? Magic Bloody School Bus is what you're going to do as your big Rush thing? And all my friends who've like read this book before me, they're like, oh, Rush, they play this big part in this book. You love it. And the trailer has like Tom Sawyer in it, and I'm like, yeah, Tom Sawyer's gonna be like our big war anthem. I mean, even when we go for like the big showdown, this huge battle between all the avatars versus the Sixers. This is what it's all building up to. And he gets in his giant mecha, because one of the final things, you all get to choose your own giant mecha. And again, this is a lot of fanboy service there. So it's sort of like, oh, he chooses the Leopard, the giant robot from Japanese Spider-Man. And he gets in it, and on the stereo, I'm thinking, oh, it's going to be a Rush track. Because, you know, Halliday programmed this, so it's going to be a Rush track. And then, like, no, it's AC/DC's Dirty D's Done Dirt Cheap. And it's like, really? That's not fitting with what you've been selling me here. And I mean, I love AC/DC, and I love that song in particular, but it doesn't fit in with the world you sold me. And it came off, that track in particular, it came off so cliche. It's like, when you read sci-fi novels, it's like, oh, let me put on my classic music, and they like play Led Zeppelin or something like that. It's sort of like, oh my god, this is just so painfully cliche right now. And when we have the big battle at the end, we've got all these mechs, and we bring out Mecha Godzilla, which I really loved. And looking at the trailer, I don't think it's going to be there, because I mean, the movie itself, I can only see being a licensing nightmare. And when I look at the trailer and I see, like, we got that big race sequence, which isn't in the book, we got the Mecha Scorpion and we got the Iron Giant, none of this is in the book. So I feel there's going to be some major changes to obviously accommodate the licensing.
You know, so I think that now's a good time, you know, like, it's suffice to say, we both are, you know, less than excited about this book, you know, like, we finished it, and, you know, it was okay, you know, it was all right, yeah.
So, it happened.
What do you expect? Yeah, it happened. I don't regret reading it. You know, like, it's not that bad, but it's not, like, as awesome as other people are saying. I really wished it was. I'm not trying to be hard on the book. I was really sold on the idea, and I still think the idea is really great. I just thought it was executed really badly. Well, poorly, not horribly. So what do you think about the movie? Like, how do you, what are your expectations? Do you, like, sure, you're saying that, you know, it's going to be a licensing nightmare. I totally agree with you on that. And, like, you're saying that certain scenes won't be there. Like, how do you think, like, what would make it good to you?
I mean,
go.
Oh, sorry, I was just about to say, well, I mean, the only footage we've got is what we've seen from Comic-Con. And I saw things like the stacks, and I saw, like, the suits, and how they're interacting with the erasers, and I was like, yeah, that's spot on, I can buy that. And then I start seeing bits that have been created for the film, such as that whole race sequence, as I said already. We have that scene of the robot scorpion, which I assume is going to be the big finale, which again, we have this amazing huge fight scene between the Avatars and the Sixers, and then we have like this really this kind of ho-hum section after that where we've got the final parts to get the egg, and it's supposed to be like this really really tense sort of sequence, but it's so laid back. We have this amazing fight sequence, and then it's like it's kind of this gentle stroll to get the final quest. It's sort of like, no rush here at all, and it just kind of killed my mood. That he sort of has my attention. We have this huge epic sequence, and then it's all like just a little just stroll for this last bit. It's all like, and I hope that the film version changes that, perhaps adds a little more tension, tightens up some of these scenes. I think perhaps not be so doting on your references. I think it would be nice if we have nods rather than just like long drawn out glances.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing, is that's why I think the movie is going to be more appealing to me than the book. And I'd really love it to be more appealing, because there is a really great story here that can be told. And despite all its cliches and the details and all that stuff, you know, I fully believe that Steven Spielberg could take a really good angle on this. The only issue is, you know, I haven't really looked into, like, who's doing the screenplay and, like, how much of this is going, like, you know, I don't know. I mean, like, I really, let's see, screenplay. I mean,
screenplay has been done by Ernest Cline and Zach Penn.
Okay.
I mean, Ernest Cline has obviously done screenplays before because he did the rather good Fanboys. Zach Penn is probably not best known for the scripts he submitted for X2 and X-Men The Last Stand.
Those are his best ones? We got issues.
he also did, I mean, he's been mainly working over at Marvel. I mean, he did, like The Avengers, he did The Incredible Hulk. Those are sort of like the main sort of things. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there that, I mean, he has done self-referential work before. I mean, he did Last Action Hero. That was his debut. And he is currently working on the Suicide Squad sequel, as well as Pacific Rim Uprising. So, yeah. It kind of has got the right sort of team working behind it. I mean, obviously, Cline is adapting his own book here, and I think if anyone was going to bring it to screen, I think it needed a visual director, so someone like Spielberg, who has obviously, he's got a blank check, really, to make this film. Because he's Spielberg, he delivers. If it had been another director, someone like Del Toro, who could have really done some incredible things with this, I think it would have been hindered by having budgetary restraints, which I don't think Spielberg's going to have. Looking at the casting choices, certain people involved that I would have not chosen to know, such as like Og is going to be played by Simon Pegg. And when I'm reading the book, I would say that's a Kevin Smith role.
Yeah, something like that. You know, I kind of see James Halliday being more of a Simon Pegg. Like, he has that kind of, like, I don't know, that kind of quirk to him that works, I guess. You know, the deal with, you know, I have full confidence that Steven Spielberg will make this good. My only issue with it is that when you look at the casting, it's very Hollywood. And, you know, Wade is not a hot boy, you know? He's supposed to be painfully normal, you know? He's a little, you know, he's a little, from the description at the beginning, you know, he's a little overweight and he loses the weight when he gets money to, you know, exercise and play games at the same time and all that stuff. And, you know, but, and then you get Ty Sheridan, which is a decent looking guy, you know? I get that it could work. But that's some of the issues is that when you change books like that, you always want to have an appealing actor to take up these appealing young actor to take up these roles because you want to get the girls to come, you know, the young girls to come and watch this. And I can get that, you know, I could get behind that. Olivia Cook is a decent choice. I can actually see her in that role as Artemis. It's okay. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird in many ways, the fact that we've obviously got the real-life versions of these characters, and then we've got the Avatar version, which are, like, the fantastic ones, yet in the film version we're looking at, they're going to be played by the same actors. So, I mean, when it comes to, obviously, like, Artemis, who's supposed to be, like, this nerd boy's wet dream of a character, and she's obviously, when we look at her real-life persona, she's more flawed.
Yeah.
So how Olivia Cook's going to obviously do that, I mean, obviously, I can see Olivia Cook playing the role. She's certainly got the feistiness. I mean, we obviously saw in Milas and the Dying Girl that she's got that sort of feistiness, and I think she's got certainly the smarts to pull off, like, a lot of the pop culture humor. I mean, I could see her obviously referencing 80s items and a lot of the things here and it being believable. I mean, this is, we obviously, when we look at the cast list here, I mean, it's no real sort of standout sort of people you got, oh, it's that sort of person. I mean, TJ Miller's obviously is in it, which I'm kind of excited to see because I like TJ Miller and things, but I think what him, Simon Pegg, everyone else is sort of like, I'm sort of looking and going, do I know that person? It's only when I obviously go deeper into like the IMDb list and it's like, oh, it's that guy, it's that girl. Mm. So, but
it's okay. I mean, I think it's a strong cast. It's a strong enough cast. They have a strong director, and I think the movie really has a fair chance of making it because it won't be hindered by, you know, like, what are they going to do? Do a flashback of War Games and then do an entire sequence? No, they're gonna let the guy play out this movie, you know? And maybe, like, take snippets of it or something. I don't know. I'm not Steven Spielberg. You know, I don't have his directing skills. You know, but, I mean, like, there are approaches that I feel he will take, which will make this a lot more of a gripping experience than what the book has offered. And that's really all I ask for. I think that I really hope that the movie will be a lot more tight-knit than the book was, you know, because the book, I felt like it could have been 100 pages shorter if you cut out most of the description.
Oh yeah.
And that would have been a great experience. That would have been a nice little, you know, average size novel, which would have been cool. You know, I would have enjoyed that. Either way, I think I would have enjoyed it more.
I think if it had not been so obvious with his loves, especially, it's sort of like, when we obviously look at, when it gets further in, I mean, we have that, as you said already, we have that horrible middle section where it just sags.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's sort of like, you've achieved your goal, and you're supposed to be all driven about this quest of the egg, but, you know, you get money, and you just become a fat ass who sits in his apartment playing video games. He becomes a shut-in. This is the thing. Mm-hmm. By his own admission, he becomes a shut-in because he basically buys his apartment and sets it with security, so he doesn't have to see anyone. He orders all his food and stuff to be delivered to him. And he has to put in all these different protocols into his system, so that he has to exercise, otherwise he can't access the Oasis, which is, it's kind of like viewing the Oasis as being like a drug in many ways to these people, like an addiction. But yeah, I mean, as you said already, they could have hacked out 100 pages out of this book, and it probably would have been a lot tighter. Perhaps not be so obvious. I mean, yes, you're going to have a spaceship, so what do you have? Oh, I've got an X-Wing, and I've got the Serenity from Firefly. And it's like, oh, that's great.
You know, I do want to see is, you know, if they were able to get all these things, it'd be really nice to see that Ultraman scene come out, because that sounds like, that is like one of the coolest parts of this book. Where they have that Ultraman transformation, and you have this whole countdown thing going on, and that special ability that it has, and, you know, there's so many cool nicks and knacks that they use, and I think that those are the nods that you need. That sort of nod where, you know, you kind of get a good idea of what this is, and when you see it, you know what it is, but, like, it's not too in your face, you know, and I feel that those parts are some of the best parts, where you're like, I'm reminded of my childhood at the same time as, you know, like, I'm reading this thing, which is super exciting because it's like plays out like an actual video game, like an actual battle in a video game.
I'm just gonna go on a limb now and say that I feel that when we look at the reference in this film, it's going to be very Americanized. So yeah. Anything relating to Japanese pop culture, so like the Mecha King Ghidorah, that would be awesome if that was in it. The Mecha Godzilla won't be in it. We won't see Ultraman. We won't see the robots from like Neon Genesis Evangelion, for example. We're just going to see I think that's how the Iron Giant's going to come into it, because that's going to be his chosen robot. He's going to ride into battle at the end, being held by the Iron Giant, and obviously our big villain here is going to have the robot Scorpion, I'm guessing, because I'm looking at, obviously, just looking at Wikipedia now, I mean, we've got the cultural references, what they've like they've got the rights to and stuff, and it's like, oh, the DC Comics universe, Kip from Knight Rider, the Ford Falcon from Mad Max, the van from the A-Team, and I think the only Japanese reference I can see here is Kaneda's motorcycle from Akira, which isn't even in the book. So they're taking all these things from like 1980s that they can get and going, yeah, we'll work that in.
What can we do, right? We'll see when it happens. Like what happens? I mean, it's not a long wait. It's supposed to come out in 2018.
Yeah.
So all these answers will be revealed. Maybe we'll even switch things up again and do a movie review. Okay. Which isn't really a switch of things for us on our other stuff, but it's a switch of things for Game Warp.
But I have to obviously ask, because there is a sequel in production at the moment, Ready Player 2, and he has got another book called Armada out. Having read this book, would you be inspired to read a sequel, or would you be inspired to read his other book?
I don't know what Armada is about, and I don't know what Ready Player 2 is going to be about. So I honestly don't know. You know, obviously some people who reviewed Ready Player 1 has mentioned that Armada is actually very similar in style to Ready Player 2. If you didn't like Ready Player 1, chances are you probably won't like Ready Player 2, the Armada. So, okay. I don't know. I mean,
when I'm reading the description of Armada, I just think it sounds like The Last Starfighter.
So. Oh, that's what a lot of people in the description are. I think a lot of people say that. Yeah, a lot of times, a writer's first book determines how much you feel intrigued about reading it. And based off my feelings of Ready Player One, I'm not exactly sure I want to read Armada. I'm feeling like his style's not really my style. Just like, you know, a controversial thing to say for some YA readers is that I'm not a John Green fan. I've read two of John Green's books and I have no particular feeling for it. Like, people love The Fault in Our Stars, and Paper Towns. And those were painfully cliche or painfully boring. it's just not my style, you know? And that's what I feel. Maybe Ernest Cline is not my style of reading. Like, I like his ideas, but I don't like the way he puts it out, you know? Like,
yeah. Other bits there, you just don't like how he constructs them.
Yeah, I just don't like the way he constructs them. And that's how an author is, you know, signified, is how he constructs his stories. And, you know, I don't think there's any problems with his writing style. I just don't like the way he forms his story, you know? And that's my main issue with it. So would I give Armada a read? Maybe I'll give it a test run in an Indigo, like a bookstore. And then I'll see if I like it. If I don't like the first chapter, I won't, you know? Yeah. I'm not in any rush to go read it, you know, to be honest.
I understand what you mean. I think the problem is, again, going back to obviously Ready Player One, the problem, as we obviously discussed, is dawning on me now when we look at where his main issues are, the barriers in his way. They're all financial based. That's the only thing that really stops him, is the fact that the Sixers have more money than him. Mm-hmm. So they're able to buy more equipment and better artifacts and things. And that's basically, that's the opposition he faces, is just people having more money than him. It's not a problem with skills. I mean, the fact he infiltrates the Sixers appointment and he's able to hack their whole system through back doors. Yeah. And it's like, whatever skill he needs, he has. As long as once he finds the direction he needs to go, then whatever he encounters, he's going to be able to solve. And that's what annoyed me. And it made the other members of his team seem kind of irrelevant, unless they're going to solve a puzzle for him.
But that's the thing, is, you know, there is a lack of character development. Like, instead of all the description, they could have replaced it with, you know, actual character development. You know, actual... Like, I get what they're trying to do, and this is like, you know, this is a solo competition. Everybody wants to win. You know, everybody wants this for themselves, and I get that, you know? But then there's also a huge emphasis on how, you know, he really just, you know, he really, like, cares about these people. And he's, you know, a very, you know, he really, like, at a certain point, didn't care about this anymore for stupid reasons, you know? And, you know, I don't like characters who become too strong too fast. And I get your point, you know, like, I understand that, and I think that's the problem, is that his character never got the right sort of development. Like, you know, all he needed was money. That's what solves your problems in the Oasis. And maybe it's a commentary on society, and I think that's even going too deep for this sort of book, is that it's a commentary on society, of how, like, you know, this is an oppressed society, and money can solve all your problems. I have no idea what to take away from that, you know, like... It's hard to be in a book that you already know that your character is going to make it out. There is no sense of danger. There is no, you know, like, maybe I'm thinking too much like a gamer, you know, like, there has to be some sort of source of danger, you know, the evil corporation, the Sixers, you know, they never got enough weight in the book to be a danger, you know, and then... You know, they were always in the background. They were always, like, one step behind. And, you know, and a lot of times it was like, you know, when he wasn't a step forward, and because he had a head start, he wasn't a step forward, it was his fault. It's because he got sidetracked. It was his own, it was his own issues, you know? And I don't know how to cheer for someone like that, you know? You know, I don't know, like, I mean, like, you know, before we hit the end, I already knew he was going to get the egg. I was like 85% sure that was going to be the ending. And then it would be that cliche ending of, you know, him being like, oh, I don't need to go into the Oasis anymore. I'm going to get the girl, you know? And it's just so cliche. Like, oh, you know, the lesson here is you should absorb the reality no matter how crappy it is.
Oh, it's such a oh my god, it's like such a nerdy quest, really. It's about the quest to amass things. It's not about
It sounds so dark, but I would have preferred this story to have ended where everybody died. You know, like, there was some sort of loss. There was no loss here. He was like, I win this, and I'm going to split all my fortune with everybody. You know, everybody's going to be rich. You know, and it doesn't make sense. You know, it's just like, you know, you guys work so hard for this. I get the camaraderie and all that sort of stuff, and I get that he's, you know, you want to make him, you know, this guy is great. You know, he knows things, he's got skills, he can hack into systems, he can take down the big evil corporation, you know, he's witty and genius. The only thing was, you know, like you said, he was poor, and now he has money, and now he's everything, you know, now he's a steal.
Yeah, it's that very cliche idea that money is going to solve everything. So the whole quest is basically to amass stuff. Because basically he gets all holiday stuff. So it's all these classic game consoles and all these classic movies. And they're going to get this unlimited money, which is going to enable them to feed everyone in the world. So world debt is going to be eliminated by him winning this competition. And that's basically what it is. Like, all the problems of the world are going to be solved because we've won. And we can now basically feed everyone. And that everything's going to be perfect because we have money now. And it's just a very, I don't know, it just seems a little too easy. It's sort of like when you watch Breakfast Club and basically the whole message is, you know, fuck your individuality. The whole thing is you must conform. Give up everything that makes you you and conform to be what society wants. And it just seems too easy. I'm hoping that Ready Player 2 gives us something. You know, maybe one of the one of our group decides, you know, I have money now, I'm going to be evil. You know, a betrayal or something like that. That's what we need. It's, I don't know, for such a...
You really see that? Because I honestly think what they're going to probably do is make the villain in this one come back out. Because it seems like this guy's got, like, a hidden agenda. You know, that's why you got, like, taken away, so maybe he'll figure out a way to get out and come back as the ultra villain. I don't know, maybe as a secret corporation, like James Bond movies builds up. You know, there's always some sort of secret corporation behind some one dude who breaks into another corporation and whatever, you know. I don't know,
maybe like Hunger Games, and we'll just get sold the same book for the second one.
I feel like the more we talk about it, the more this book just gets worse and worse. Yeah. I'm starting to feel like maybe I shouldn't be dissecting this book anymore, because this book's not really, like, a book that you can dissect. You know, there's not really that much depth in this book, and I think that's one of the main issues, and we have to find a way to wrap this up.
Okay. Yeah, I think if you like books where they basically list your favorite things and say, essentially, look, here's the favorite thing you like. here I put it in the context of a story for you. This is basically what Ready Player One does. It just basically gives you nostalgic memories of things under the guise mm-hmm. of nerdy cred. Yeah. But doesn't do it in a clever or particularly interesting way. It just throws things out there and banks on your nostalgia to give it to make it fly.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing, is, you know, if you have 80s nostalgia, and really, like, you really have heavy, heavy 80s nostalgia, then sure, go ahead, give this book a read. I can't say that I highly recommend it. It's not really my type of book. I didn't appreciate the style of it. But hey, maybe it's for you, you know?
Yeah, I mean, now it's obviously just the case. Wait until March to see how the film differs. And I'm kind of interested, because, I mean, all I've heard is the fanboys, like, completely going ape for how excited they are from the trailer.
You know what? Fanboys are going to be disappointed if a lot of the cool scenes get switched out a lot. And that's one of the main issues with adaptations, is that fans, who especially book readers, have a very high imagination level where they have already envisioned something a certain way. And the challenge is to live up to that. And that's why adaptations usually fall flat and don't have that sort of love, is because people, there is a certain group of people who want something to be replicated exactly like the book, so that people who don't read get to see that same experience. And then there's also the group of people who don't mind those changes, because the reality is that movies have to be done in a different way in order to be captivating to watch. And which it all falls into how this movie is going to be executed. And that's what we're going to see in March, which I am excited about. I really think it's going to be a much more pleasant experience, despite the fact that they probably don't have the extensiveness of all the cool references, like foreign references that they had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess it's just a case of waiting and seeing now. And needless to say, we will no doubt be on the internet within seconds of the film ending to voice out our opinion on this. But we hope you've obviously enjoyed this random diversion for ourselves. We thought, obviously, being gaming press that we might as well, and gaming fans, that we might as well give our thoughts on the book, seeing as it was obviously so heavily based in gaming culture. And I think it's decidedly middling reviews from myself and Kim.
Sadly, I really did want to like this. Thanks so much for watching. This is more of a podcast than our usual video. Hopefully you did enjoy it, and you can read more of our gaming reviews over on our home base, thatmomentin.com. You can check out gaming news and gaming releases updated every day on our Facebook and Twitter at GameWarp Podcast. You can also find out our gaming obsessions and random gaming thoughts that we have over on Instagram at instagram.com/GameWarpPodcast. And maybe you'll even join us for a stream over on Twitch, twitch.tv/GameWarpPodcast. Thanks so much for watching. Bye!